We're returning this morning to the Genesis narrative. It is a bit of a unique text, as you heard. This is concerning the death and the burial of Sarah. You might wonder, what do we glean from that? But I trust that God will instruct us. He will teach us this morning. There are some encouraging and beautiful theological truths that are represented by both Sarah and Abraham in this text. So in order to kind of move us along in the narrative, remember that a little bit of time now has passed after the very climactic account of Abraham and Isaac on Mount Moriah. So life has returned to really whatever normal life looked like for Abraham and Sarah and Isaac. And from Moses' perspective in the story, the Abrahamic narratives have really, for the most part, been told. He's told us the important pieces of Abraham's life. And so he begins what we might call the epilogue of Abraham, in which Moses is transitioning the reader's attention. He's moving us toward the Jacob narratives. And he does that by way of Isaac and Rebekah. So there are a few essential things that need to happen here. As we heard a moment ago, one day word came to Abraham concerning his brother Nahor. Now you may remember, or you may not remember, Nahor from the genealogy of Terah that was found immediately before the Abrahamic narratives began. So this was back in Genesis chapter 11, right before God made his initial covenant with Abraham. So Nahor, he and Abraham's niece, Milcah, this is on the left side, which was Haran's son. So the three brothers, Haran, Nahor, and Abram, at the time, Nahor marries Milcah, Haran's son. Now the text tells us at the end of chapter 22, which is really this transition piece, it tells us that they had eight sons together, Nahor and Milcah did, one of whom was Bethuel. Now, Bethuel was the father of Rebekah, and she is the singular girl that is named in the genealogy, which causes her to stand out, and that is certainly intentional. So as we'll see next week, what's happening at the end of chapter 22 is that Moses is really foreshadowing, he's planting a seed in the narrative from which, or out of which, the story is going to blossom. He's foreshadowing the next matriarch is what he's doing in this text when he says, "And Bethuel begot Rebekah." There she sort of shines. Like, why is she in there? The reason is that she will become the next matriarch. Now, the only reason that you would have a next matriarch is if the existing matriarch passes away. And the only way that you would have a next matriarch is if the son, Isaac, marries, and he's unmarried. So those really are those two stories, the story of the death of the existing matriarch and the marriage of the son that Rebekah might be the next matriarch is really this week and next week, chapters 23 and 24. So Sarah lives 127 years. These were the years of the life of Sarah. So Sarah died in Kirjath Arba, that is Hebron, in the land of Canaan. And Abraham came to mourn for Sarah and to weep for her. I intended to say a word of prayer before we read that. Let's go ahead and entreat the Lord's blessing on this time, and then we'll jump into the narrative. God, we plead that your Spirit that is in us would instruct us in truth. We have opened your book. We have read your words. This is your inspired text. It is your revelation about yourself. It is your revelation about history, our history, the history of covenant. And so we thank you for it. We humble ourselves beneath it. We ask that you would instruct us, that it would be as your living word is, supremely relevant to our lives. And that you would give me grace in speaking and your people grace in hearing, that there would be assimilation of these truths by the strength and instruction of your Spirit into the lives of our church family. In so doing, we will be built up into Christ. We will be grown into maturity. We trust you to accomplish this work. It's in Jesus' name we pray. Amen. So to put everything in perspective, as Sarah has now died, 20 to 25 years has passed since the last narrative. So 20 to 25 years since Abraham had obediently walked to the top of Mount Moriah with Isaac. Isaac is now 36 years old, which makes Abraham 136 years old. And he's going to outlive Sarah by another 39 years. It's another thing that Moses will recount for us in this epilogue of Abraham. It is fascinating to consider, isn't it, just how at times Moses slows down. It's extraordinarily slow, perhaps to notice a moment or a day or even a period of a few days, slowing down so extremely to even record specific words that were spoken. And then other times, it's like the fast-forward button is pressed, and well, do we even have fast-forward buttons anymore? We don't really have that anymore. But the fast-forward button is pressed, and we move two decades. You know, we move a significant period of time to where we don't even know all of what has happened, but Isaac is now an adult, and Sarah is now aged significantly. She's passing away. Abraham is older. All of this happens. So it's very interesting to see when he speeds up and when he slows down. And now Moses slows intentionally to record the death of Sarah and Abraham's determination to bury her in the land of promise. It's one of the significant pieces of this text. So she's 127 years old. She dies in Kirjath Arba, which is the city of Arba, an ancient name for Hebron, as you can read there from Joshua. So what has happened in Hebron? What's the significance of this place that Sarah dies? The last we knew, they were living in Beersheba. So there seems to be, as is consistent with Abraham, a sojourning, a continued moving. They're going back and forth, probably primarily between these two places, but perhaps others as well. Hebron is the place that Abraham dwelled after he split with Lot. That was the first time that we hear of Hebron in the narrative. He asks Lot to choose. Lot chooses the choicer land, and Abram moves to Hebron, and there he builds an altar. He lives there until immediately following the judgment of Sodom and Gomorrah, when he journeyed south to Gerar and eventually to Beersheba. So it was in Hebron that God cut his covenant with Abraham in chapter 15. It was in Hebron that Sarah thought of seed through surrogacy with the Hagar situation. It was in Hebron that God gave Abraham circumcision as a sign of the covenant in chapter 17. It was in Hebron that God committed to giving the promised seed within a calendar year. It was in Hebron that Abraham and Sarah even entertained the Lord himself before he moved to judge Sodom and Gomorrah. Hebron has great significance to this patriarchal pair. It is the geographical center, as you can see, of the southern half of Canaan, which really is where Abraham and Sarah spent most of their time. It's where Abraham had reputation. It is where he had his land and flocks, not land, but his flocks and his wealth were built in the southern half of the kingdom. We'll see as we move to Jacob that Jacob really lives more in the northern half of Canaan. And so it is in this very special place, and it is fitting here that the beloved and faithful matriarch Sarah takes her last breath in Hebron. So what does Abraham do? Quite naturally, in verse 2, he's mourning the loss of his dear wife, likely carrying out these traditional, you know, mourning ceremonies or these customs, things like tearing your garment and disheveling your hair and cutting your beard and scattering dust on your head and fasting. And often these rites were carried out even, maybe odd to us, but these often were carried out even in the presence of the corpse. And it was part of the finality of what was happening. It was a recognition and a mourning of the death. And so that explains some of the language where it says that Abraham came to mourn for Sarah and weep for her, and then he stood up from before his dead and spoke to the sons of Heth. So this is describing the customs of mourning your loss. He's lost his wife, the wife of his youth, his faithful covenant companion. He's lost Sarah, his beautiful princess. She is dead. And so he rises, meaning in verse 3, I'll just leave the sort of the outline up on the screen. We have three panels, three repetitive pieces of this interaction where Abraham rises from his mourning and he arranges a meeting with these Hittite leaders, leaders in Hebron, leaders in Mamre. These are all synonymous areas or maybe different territories that kind of overlap one another. So he's likely talking to the elders of the nearby city. And the interaction that follows is quite unique, as we heard this morning, not even very familiar probably to us. And it recounts this extended negotiation between Abraham and the Hittites. The negotiation concerns property. It concerns a burial plot. That's what Abraham is after. And so in each of these cycles, Abraham makes a proposition to which the Hittites or a Hittite respond. And then the parties address one another in each of these very respectfully, probably in Hittite customs with these repeated, hear before me, hear me, my Lord, and the bowing that's occurring. It's this customary respectful interaction that's taking place, perhaps even a very legal interaction that's taking place. And then in every cycle, the topic is restated, bury my dead, bury your dead. Property. I want a possession. That's really the point of it. And those repeat in each of these cycles. Abraham wants property to bury his dead, and they, the Hittites, are willing to give it to him. So in the first cycle, which is 3-6, Abraham, he introduces himself with a statement about his status. He says, I am a foreigner and a visitor among you. So he's identifying his lack of status, his lack of even safety and security. He's almost identifying himself as, you remember when the angels traveled into Sodom, he says, they're visitors, they're guests, and it's a very vulnerable thing to be a visitor. So he's saying, that's really who I am. I don't own anything here. I own no land. There's nothing to my name. I mean, down in Beersheba, I have a well that I built or that I dug. That I have rights to, but nothing really belongs to Abraham at all. Abimelech has simply let him use the land and dwell peacefully upon it. So he's a vulnerable visitor who's really presenting himself as, I'm living on the fringe of society. I don't have anything to my name. And so he makes his intentions crystal clear. I intend to purchase from you a burial plot here in this land among you so that I can bury my wife, and he doesn't say this explicitly, but so that he can bury her in the land of promise. Abraham's posture is very low. It's humble. After all, as we think about who he is, this is significant because Abraham is, while he may be a sojourner, he is a very wealthy man, isn't he? He has a lot of possessions. God has blessed him. Abimelech has seen it. The Hittites have seen it. Everybody knows that Abraham worships Yahweh and that Yahweh has blessed Abraham. And God has also very specifically promised to Abraham the very land in which he resides as a guest. So if we look back to chapter 15, the Lord made a covenant with Abraham saying, to your descendants, I have given this land. This is happening in Hebron. From the river of Egypt to the great river, the river Euphrates, the Kenites, the Kenizzites, the Kadmonites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Rephaim, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Girgashites, and the Jebusites. So even though he will own the very property promised by God on which this very negotiation is taking place, Abraham postures himself with humility and ultimately with what is faith. He postures himself with faith. I'm going to purchase a small plot for the full price in order to bury my deceased love. And this first cycle is when the group responds, the elders respond, before a particular person is chosen by Abraham to interact with. So they all say, the sons of Heth, the Hittites, answer Abraham and say to him, hear us, my Lord. You're not a foreigner and a sojourner. You are a mighty prince among us. Bury your dead in the choicest of our burial places. None of us will withhold from you his burial place that you may bury your dead. And so they respond quite warmly, even elevating his status. You're not a stranger. You're a mighty prince. You're a, the literal word is a prince of God. is what you are. We're very well aware of your success and your abundance. You've lived among us for a very long time, and we view you quite highly. None of us will withhold from you using our burial plot. None of us will withhold from you an opportunity to bury your wife peacefully on our land. More than welcome to do that. Pick your place. Even the best place, the best burial ground in our country will not be withheld from you. And so they are sympathetic toward him, and they let him use any of their burial grounds. That leads us to cycle 2, verses 7 through 11. Even with the generous offer, you've noticed even in how I just sought to emphasize that, the Hittites didn't address Abraham's true point, did they? He desires possession. He's demanding ownership. It's time for me, now that my wife has died, to stake my claim in this land. And we don't know exactly how Abraham is appearing. If he's still even, we don't know if he's now washed his face and anointed his head with oil and presenting himself well, or if he's appearing with torn clothes and ashes on dust on his head and a cut beard. We don't really know, but this is an emotional appeal. Now you're saying, my wife is dead. Give me a place to put her, my own place to put her. And so while maintaining, you know, this honorable stance, he replies, now if you truly are agreeing to bury my dead here, then the place that I choose is Ephron's place or Ephron's place. And I want his cave, the cave at Machpelah, at the end of his field. And I'm going to purchase that cave at full price in front of all of you. I want no dispute over the fact that I own it. Just a cave at the end of his field. But I will buy it fairly, and it will be mine. So Ephron, who dwelt among the sons of Heth, the Hittite, answered Abraham in the presence of the sons of Heth, all who answered at the gate of his city, saying, in verse 11, "No, my lord, hear me. I give you the field and the cave that is in it. I give it to you in the presence of the sons of my people. I give it to you. Bury your dead." So he answers from among the group and seems to be in quite warm agreement with the previous offer from the elders, right? Choose whichever one you want. He chose mine, so I stand. And well, maybe it's the pressure of all the people, maybe it's his own true desire, but he offers to Abraham his land. Now, there's a few different ways to interpret kind of the emotion or the interaction between these two groups, and I don't know that we can have complete clarity or confidence in what they are. There are a lot of cultural issues at play, even Hittite cultural issues at play that we can't be totally confident of. Ephron may have responded with supreme generosity, you know, and offered Abraham even more than what he asked. Abraham asked for the cave. He says, no, I give you the field and the cave. I give you the whole thing. My whole piece of property is yours. And that, you know, seems to pair well with this generous offer from the entire group and from the three uses of give in verse 11. I give it to you, I give it to you, I give it to you, go bury your dead. Or there's a possibility here that if you just think of, a peace treaty that's occurred between these two people and these people groups, but they are, you know, warlords interacting with one another. These are mighty people who are interacting, who have accountability for others. And now there's an interaction. What happens if something goes wrong? What happens if someone missteps, if someone's disrespected? Where does this go from there? It's difficult to really tell, because a possibility of what's happening is he's still saying, I give it to you, meaning go have it. But who is deeded the property is the question. The land is in whose name? Ephron's or Abraham's? And that's what Abraham's still after. He's like, this is what I need. This is what I need. I need it in my name. So it's a little bit difficult to know how friendly this is, but it does appear that way on its face, I think. So it's kind of hard to confidently assess the relationship between the two groups. But again, I do believe the trifold use of give in verse 11, as well as the generous statement above, favors genuineness rather than duplicity. So Ephron advances the offer, not just the cave, the whole property. and I give it to you in the presence of everybody as these witnesses. That leads us to our third cycle, verses 12 through 15. One other thing that Abraham needs to do. He bows himself down before the people of the land. He speaks to Ephron in the hearing of the people of the land, saying, "If you will give it, hear me. I will give you money for the field. Take it from me, and then I will bury my dead there. I need to pay for this." And Ephron answers, saying, "My lord, listen to me. Here's what the land is worth, but what's that between you and me? So bury your dead." So to this relatively forceful request in verses 12 and 13, particularly verse 13, Ephron names the price of 400 silver shekels. If you remember back to the Abimelech narrative, he gave Abraham, to make himself blameless, 1,000 silver shekels. So this we do seem to be dealing in larger quantities of money here. We don't know if this is the fair price for the field or just Ephron's like, okay, well, here you go. If you want the full price, here's the full price. And he states a rather exorbitant one. We don't fully know what the land is actually worth. But Abraham says, there's no negotiations. You state the price, I pay it. Perhaps they're both just so rich, so well off, that Ephron's like, why are we doing this? What's the point? And everyone's like, I don't care. Here's a blank check. You say it, I pay it, and then it's mine. So, Abraham's insistent. Then the story comes to a pretty quick resolution, and the legal proceedings are finalized. Moses is very clear to be up front, say, okay, so Abraham listens. Abraham weighed out 400 shekels for Ephron, which Ephron named in the hearing of all the Hittites, 400 shekels of silver, the currency of the merchants. I'm using fair scales, like it's completely above board. And the result of this is that the field of Ephron, he just keeps restating, like, so that's very clear, the field of Ephron, which was in Machpelah, which was before Mamre, the field and the cave both, the whole property, and all the trees that were in the field, everything inside these borders, the entire thing, which was within the surrounding borders, were deeded to Abraham as a possession in the presence of all the Hittites before all who went into the gate of his city. So not just the elders, all the people, everyone sees it, everyone acknowledges it, way above board, blameless, indisputable. It's mine. I bought it. And everyone acknowledges that. And so then in 19 and 20, we have the final conclusion, which is the result of buying and owning the field. After this, Abraham buried Sarah, his wife, in the cave of the field of Machpelah, before Mamre, that is Hebron, in the land of Canaan. So the field and the cave that is in it were deeded to Abraham by the Hittites as property, possession, for a burial place. So you can see all throughout, really and you won't be able to read, but just visually, the darker marks, the sort of orangey-brown marks, those are all the mentions of burial and death. That's what Abraham's doing. And how he's doing it is the green. Possession, mine, my property. And what I didn't highlight that we could is, where is that property? Among you, in the land of Canaan, in this land of promise. That's where it has to be. That Sarah's death and burial on purchased promised land property is the point of the story, is evidenced by this repetition. So what do we do with this account? It is a little odd. It's a little unusual. Of the 20 years of not slowing down, 25 years of not slowing down, now Moses slows down to talk about Ephron, the Hittite, and Abraham in this great exchange? And there are significant theological implications for us, both from Sarah and from Abraham. So I'd encourage you this morning that Sarah teaches us how to die well. Sarah teaches us how to die well. Keep in mind, when Sarah dies, has she or has she not seen the promises of God fully fulfilled? No, not even close. In each of them, they've seen glimpses, right? You have the promise of seed. Imagine having been promised that you will be the mother of a nation as vast as the stars of the sky and the sands of the sea. And you live until you're 127 years old. And what do you have to show? One son. You're not even a grandma. You don't have a sink. Your son's not even married. You don't have a grand nation. You don't have sands of the sea and stars of the sky. That still sounds like a fairy tale. That's not her actualization. That's not her realized evidence of the promise, right? That's not there for her. She's seen Isaac. Granted, that was miraculous, was it not? God was intentionally designed to make it undeniably miraculous, but as miraculous and wonderful as he is, he's just one kid. Land. Imagine having been promised that you would possess a land as far as the eye could see. But your life, your home as a mother, has been a tent. And you have moved back and forth and here and there all over this promised land, living on the property and off of the generosity and the peace treaties of other powerful people who are established in these lands. So as wonderful as the tent in Hebron is and these trees at Mamre, and as wonderful as the well down in Beersheba and the peace treaty is with Abimelech, as wonderful as all those things are, and as much as they have moved them incrementally, baby steps toward the reception of the land, she dies with them not owning a single piece of any property in Canaan. How about the blessing? Imagine having been told that all those who bless you will be blessed, and all those who curse you will be cursed, and your family will bless all the nations of the earth. But the people around you flourish while you sojourn within a region or two of your entire adult life. Now there's moments of blessing. You have Abraham rescuing Lot from Chedorlaomer, and the blessing from Melchizedek, and you have some protection of God hearing Abraham and Abraham's intercession on behalf of righteous. And you know that Abimelech's coming to make a peace treaty with you because he sees that you're blessed by God. Like, it's there. But come on, comparatively, they're still experiencing shadows of the reality. And yet with all of that, Hebrews 11 says that Sarah died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, she was assured of them, and she embraced and confessed, "I'm a stranger and a pilgrim on the earth." That is beautiful, and that is instructive toward our lives as believers walking in faith toward promises yet received. And the possibility, nay, the probability, if we are to join this cloud of witnesses, the overwhelming 100% majority, maybe minus like a smidgen of a percent for one or two people that didn't die, everyone dies before they've received the promise. Even people of faith. So suffering and death most often precede the promise. This is so strongly emphasized in the New Testament that you could pick any book of the New Testament and it's there. It talks about waiting. It talks about perseverance. It talks about endurance. John 16, I'll just read a few of them. John 16, Jesus says, "Most assuredly I say to you, you will weep and lament, and the world is going to rejoice. You'll be sorrowful, but your sorrow will be turned into joy. A woman, when she is in labor, has sorrow because her hour has come, but as soon as she has given birth to the child, she no longer remembers the anguish for that joy. Because a human being has been born into the world. Therefore, you now have sorrow, but I will see you again, and your heart will rejoice, for your joy and your joy no one will take from you." And a few verses later, "Indeed, the hour is coming, yes, and now has come, that you will be scattered, each to his own, and will leave me alone. And yet I am not alone, because the Father is with me. These things I have spoken to you, that in me you may have peace. In the world, you will have tribulation, you'll have trouble. But be of good cheer, I have overcome the world." Do we not learn this through our study of 2 Peter? Do we not hear in 2 Peter 3 that we should be mindful of the words of the prophets and the words of the apostles, because scoffers are going to come and they're going to mock what? Unmet promises. They're going to say, from the time Sarah died, nothing's changed. Why are you believing it? That's what a mocker will say. Where is God? Where is the promise? Where is the land? Where is the blessing? Where is the seed? They'll say, they'll ridicule it. But the very world on which we live came forth from and is preserved by the very word of God. He is eternal. He does not function on a clock as we do. Today is not our day, but the day of the Lord will come. And in our union with him, that is our day. Death is this very uncomfortable and sensitive topic, isn't it? We don't like talking about it very much. None of us have experienced it, but if the Lord tarries, then all of us will. I'd encourage you not to forget that death is the next step toward true life. We ought not fear or even overcomplicate death. It is a divine appointment that God will see us through. He will be faithful. It is this final and great revealer of our faith. And yet the very moment at which we die, our faith then turns to sight. God has promised to ransom us from the power of the grave and to redeem us from the power of death. We know the true and the living Christ. He is the head of the body, the church, who is the beginning. He is the firstborn from the dead, that in all things he might have the preeminence. We believe and have hope in this Christ who lives today. And so like Sarah, like we should do as she did. We should die in faith. We should die in belief, trusting the promises of God, whether we see them or whether we don't, whether we taste them or believe we will taste them. Not having the promise today is not evidence against the veracity of the promise. And so we follow the example of Sarah and countless others who died in faith, believing that promise. Finish well, my family. Whether you are aged and near death humanly, or you are young and never know when you will taste death, let us learn from Sarah. But Abraham teaches us as well. Abraham teaches us how to suffer loss in faith. We often say when somebody dies, well, it's more difficult, perhaps, for the people that remain, don't we? Because you're the ones that taste the pains of loss, of lack, of the frustration of absence. Abraham loses his spouse. He loses the love of his life, and he is deeply grieved. But the patriarch, through his tremendous mourning, is rooted in hope. Abraham's resolve to bury his wife here on this ground that God has promised to me among the people of the land who don't even believe in the God that he's walking with, that expresses tremendous faith. He could have more easily, taken Sarah back to the land of his family. I have my brother there. His family's there. They have burial plots there. That's who I'm related to. I'll go home. Bury my wife. Tell my sons to bury me up with my brother, where my father even was buried. But Abraham chooses instead to place his wife's body in the ground, in the promised ground, as a seed of hope that God will keep his promise. See, a life of faith, as we've observed in Abraham, is not an event. It's something that occurs time after time after time. It's a habit, a way of life. That's how faith shows up. So from a human perspective, Abraham is walking the ancient path of Yahweh. It's a path that's described by Moses. It's a path that's described by Solomon. It's a path that's described even negatively, people having not followed it, by the prophets. It's a path that's described and lived by Jesus himself. It's a path that we're called to walk the ancient way of the fear of the Lord, faith in God, trusting that he is good, trusting that he will keep his promise. And so Abraham is doing that. I'd encourage then those who are further down this path not to look for novelty as you reach the end of your life. Don't look for something different. Continue. Take the next step of faith, down the path of faith, this ancient one that you've even made a habit of walking. There's nothing new at the end, nothing different at the end. Carry on. And for the young people, one, get on the path of this ancient path of wisdom. There's Proverbs for you. And watch, observe, learn from those who are aged. Learn from those who have been walking down this path for a time, because in their example, you see the life to live. That's what we've done with Abraham. He lived it faithfully. He was willing to give everything for the Lord. None of God's gifts superseded his love and faith for God. We saw that 2 weeks ago. And when we saw that he rested time after time, and he failed time after time too, but he took the next step as a righteous man down the path of wisdom. There are a lot of implications for that, but I'd like to show you at the end, the very end of Genesis. Genesis 49. The implications of Abraham's faith here. We are now to Abraham's grandson, Jacob, and his children, Joseph and others. Jacob is now in the position of Sarah and Abraham, where he's the old man, and he's dying. Look with me in verse 29. This is his instruction. Then he charged them, which is his sons, his boys, and he said to them, I am to be gathered to my people. Bury me with my fathers in the cave that is in the field of Ephron the Hittite. In the cave that is in the field of Machpelah, which is before Mamre in the land of Canaan, which Abraham bought with the field of Ephron the Hittite as a possession for a burial place. There they buried Abraham and Sarah, Sarah his wife. There they buried Isaac and Rebekah his wife. And there I buried Leah. The field and the cave that is there were purchased from the sons of Heth. And when Jacob had finished commanding his sons, he drew up his feet into the bed, breathed his last, and was gathered to his people. That's the implication of Abraham's faith. It is beautiful. It's stunning. The generational impact that it had on his sons and how they, through their own faults and failures, because that's not ultimately the point, rested in the promises of God, walked by faith, and died well, just like their grandmother and their grandfather and their father and their mother and his wife, and his sons are going to as well. Joseph then instructs, like his is a little bit unique. He instructs, though, to be taken back to the land as well, though he's not buried. in the cave. Today, let us follow in their footsteps. Let us be willing to suffer loss well. Let us be willing to plant our dead into the grave with hope, because this is not the end. This is not the end. And what we're seeing around us is, as we've talked often, is a shadow of the true and greater things that are to come. They are real, but they are frustrating. The brokenness of this world is filled with frustration. And yet we can live by faith in the promises of God. And so Abraham now receives for the first time ownership of a piece of Canaan. The land promise advances once again. I'd like to conclude this morning by reading a large portion of Hebrews 11. As we're coming to the end of Abraham's life, it will be up on the screen if you'd like it there as well. We're coming to the end of Abraham's life. And the promises of God, they acknowledge, Abraham does, and many, all other people that live with faith acknowledge, that they're not going to be fulfilled fully in this broken world. Therefore, this broken world cannot be truly my home. It cannot be. It is not my final resting place. A part of the promise is the promise of restoration and newness. So I will confidently place my faith in that. And this text encourages even the Hebrew people. It says, look at your history. It is filled with faith-filled people. And what drove them? What drove them was looking to Jesus, the author and finisher of their faith. So I'd like to encourage you by reading Hebrews 11, and we'll conclude with that. It says, by faith Abraham obeyed when he was called to go out to the place which he would receive as an inheritance, and he went out, not knowing where he was going. By faith he dwelt in the land of promise as a foreign country, dwelling in tents with Isaac and with Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise, for he waited for the city which has foundations, whose builder and maker is God. By faith, Sarah herself also received strength to conceive seed, and she bore a child when she was past the age, because she judged him, God, faithful, who had promised. Therefore, from one man, and him as good as dead, were born as many as the stars of the sky in multitude, innumerable as the sand which is by the seashore. These all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, were assured of them, embracing them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. For those who say such things declare plainly that they seek a homeland. And truly, if they had called to mind that country from which they had come out, they would have had opportunity to return. But now they desire a better, that is, a heavenly country. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. By faith, Abraham, when he was tested, he offered up Isaac, and he who had received the promises offered up his only begotten son, of whom it was said, in Isaac your seed shall be called, concluding that God was able to raise him up even from the dead, from which he also received him in a figurative sense. By faith, Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau concerning things to come. By faith, Jacob, when he was dying, blessed each of the sons of Joseph and worshipped, leaning on the top of his staff. By faith, Joseph, when he was dying, made mention of the departure of the children of Israel and gave instructions concerning his bones. And all these, having obtained a good testimony through faith, did not receive the promise. God having provided something better for us, that they should not be made perfect apart from us. Therefore, we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and the finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and he sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Therefore, since we are receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken, let us have grace by which we may serve God acceptably with reverence and godly fear.